people have powerful feelings about the traffic in Los Angeles, it says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want to go all the way to the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home, across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you can even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go down Fares, another tier, and in about 5 minutes we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line, there's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast the tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard. Too Many People could also be a motto for It's Casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with Freeways, with People, or his native LA. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know why everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's Casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. I-5, the I-10.
Welcome to another edition of Los Angeles Nista, live from downtown Los Angeles via SkidRowStudios.com on Olive Street. I have been very inspired. Today's Wednesday, February 27th. And the 25th, I had James Rhoda in as an in-studio guest, who's a producer of the Sound City movie. And it was just a great conversation. And I was just really amazed by how much work has come out of that particular studio. And, you know, obviously the documentary is, I think, 2 hours long around there. They can't use everyone who has ever worked there. You know, I guess there's only so much screen time. But on that episode, a gentleman named Robert Morfitt, he actually called in to share a story, some stories with James and I. And to me, it just added to the episode. I thought it was great to get a different perspective from someone coming from, you know, a different country like Canada. And he's actually based out of Los Angeles now. So I said, hey, why don't you come in and let's continue the inspired, stoked Sound City episodes. And he's here. So, Robert, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know what? I was really excited when you called in, and I just felt like that was just a little, you know, dash of information that you shared. And I just think you have a lot more to talk about regarding working there.
Well, perhaps I do.
Yeah. You know, in addition to the Sound City thing, you know, this is Los Angeles Nista. So we'll do the first hour about your experiences with your band at Sound City. And we'll go into the traditional Los Angeles Nista format after. And, you know, we're going to talk about your favorite places to go, where it's venues, recording studios, galleries, any kind of, you know, place where someone could enjoy something. It could be a park. And then I'll follow up and let everyone know how to get there by public transportation.
There we go.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the history of Econoline Crush. Tell us what year it started and how it came about.
Well, in 92 is when it started, and it was started by the singer, and whose name is Trevor. And he had answered an ad in the Rocket, of all places, in okay. Seattle. And he's actually a Canadian guy, but in turn, in his previous band, he'd ended up with this management that had brought the world Queensryche. And so he was hanging around their pad in Seattle looking for a new band. And it turned out a guy in Vancouver, where he was living, had placed an ad. So it was kind of a weird, like, he's in Seattle answering an ad for a band in Vancouver. So he goes back to Vancouver. He makes this band with this guy from Mauve, and they end up calling it Econoline Crush. Fast forward, they're looking for another guitar player after playing a show. And, you know, they'd put together some recordings, and they'd ended up, you know, they were pretty dialed in. So right away they were on the radio in Vancouver, and they're having people show up to their show. And there's a pretty big buzz on about them. So going through the process of doing their first show, they realized, hey, like, we need some more guys here that are a little more serious than a couple of the characters they had. So that's how I got into the mix. And I was living in Seattle. I got a call from some guy in Vancouver. And I grew up in Vancouver. I was born and raised in Vancouver. Okay. So it was no trouble to hop the bus back to Vancouver and rehearse with these guys. And it was kind of weird. Like, they were managed by this husband and wife team. And I actually knew the son. He owns a bunch of record stores in Seattle, and still does, I believe.
Like an independent chain?
Yeah, an independent called Easy Street. So we kind of had this, like, you know, this 6 degrees of separation right. thing going on.
I actually know Easy Street very well. I've been selling direct to them on my day job, Southern Lord. I've been dealing with them since 2004.
Yeah, so Matt Vaughn, who owns Easy Street.
Okay.
His mother, Diana, and his stepfather, Kim Harris, they used to own the Easy Street that is in Kirkland, or was in Kirkland.
Okay.
So, and anyway, you know, fast forward, as soon as I joined, like, you know, the band was already sort of fast-tracked onto, you know, there's a lot of deals going down at the time, and, you know, we ended up getting a deal pretty quickly with EMI Canada. So we were signed and, you know, playing shows after our first. We did a tour. I think I did like 26 shows with these guys and, you know, drove across Canada in a school bus and went to Toronto and showcased for some people, because Toronto and Canada is like the center of, you know, whatever, the universe. It's like,
right.
you know, Canada's little New York, if you will.
Right.
And yeah, we got a deal and made some records, and we got around to making our third record, was the one that ended up being produced by Sylvia Massey over at Sound City.
Okay, so let's get into that timeline of the band. So when that record was being written, Did you guys, while writing it, knew like, okay, we're going to write these tunes, we're going to pre-production, and then we're going to get Sylvia Massey and go to Sound City. Did you have a plan, or did it all just kind of fall into place?
No, it wasn't really like that. We knew we were demoing songs in Vancouver at various locations, and it was funny because we didn't know who was going to do the album. We had actually just let go of a manager. So we were in like this major state of flux, this transition where we're like, who's going to manage us? So the record company's like lining us up to all these potential managers. But a guy in Vancouver who's, you know, big management type there, Bruce Allen, had his eye on the band. And there's a few people in his office who were into the band as well. So what had happened was, you know, in the process of looking for these managers, also producers were coming up on the forefront. And Trevor had spoken to this fellow who managed a Canadian band called I Mother Earth, and he couldn't go on about this producer Sylvia Massey enough, because he had just had her do a record for one of his bands, and he's just like, the experience was great. The record company loved her too. He was just like all magic. So, you know, Trevor ended up having a phone call with her, and she was super excited. She got the demos, and, you know, working with her, the funny thing was, is, you know, so then it's like, okay, I think we're going to LA. So, you know, to get out, and at that point, we kind of wanted to get out of Vancouver with all the different changes that we had had going on in our state of affairs. It was refreshing to come down here and, you know, be able to just, you know, focus on, you know, doing the best that we could on this recording.
Right. And as far as, share the experience when you first entered Sound City. I mean, now there's a movie out that's, you know,
well, it's much like the movie, to tell you the truth. So, you know, I went and saw the movie the weekend it came out.
Right. Can you relate to that road trip, or did you guys fly in?
Well, I flew in, but I can totally relate to, like, you know, Vancouver's a little bit further north of Seattle.
Sure, that's why I bring that up. Yeah.
You know, and I have like been around some places at the beginning that looked much like the house there. Like, he caught my crush kind of, you know, the first time I joined these guys, they had a place at like, God, it was like just off of Broadway. It's like 8th and it's like right in East Van. You know, there's like hookers out on the corner and, you know,
it's chaos.
Yeah, it's a sketchy neighborhood. And so, yeah, I could totally relate to like going, you know, getting away. And, but at that point, you know, we it was a big trek. Everybody came down, and you know, we did some pre-production in the there's actually a rehearsal room or studios actually directly across from Sound City.
Now, is that a whole different building, a whole different company?
Well, I don't know how closely related they were, but I mean, it seemed to me that it was common that people would, you know, if they were coming from out of town, that they would probably do pre-production rehearsals there, which is what we did with Sylvia, right, and then move over to Sound City. It was sort of just across the courtyard, if you will.
Okay.
And yeah, it was exciting. We came down here, and you know, when you see the film, you know, they walk in and there's the, you know, the builds up to where, you know, Nirvana had done the album, but prior to that, you know, there's the Dio, the Rat, the Tom Petty, you know,
Fleetwood Mac.
All these records everybody's heard, for sure.
Springfield, Fogerty.
Yeah, but the other thing that hits you is, like, it's not really a fancy place. So it's like you're seeing all these, like, gold and platinum records, and it's like a real sort of down-to-earth, dirty studio.
So let me stop you there and ask you a question, okay? So when you have a perception of it from being a Canadian musician in a different country, and, you know, you guys are touring around, but, and you're listening to a lot of music, you're playing it, and you're a fan of a lot of these records that are on the walls of Sound City. When you walk in, you probably had this perception, maybe like, wow, I mean, this must be a plush place.
Well, no,
I not really.
No, none of us actually even knew the history of the studio before we got there. So really, upon walking through the door, it's like, whoa, Nirvana did their record here.
Okay.
And so then, oh.
It all just Rat did their record here. As you were taking steps.
No. We didn't know, because there was no Sound City movie. There's not like there's this movie or this exposure. Yeah. You know, all we knew was we were doing this record with this woman, Sylvia Massey, who's, you know, worked closely with Prince and Rick Rubin. And we knew sort of what, and she had just worked at, you know, she'd done the Tool record at Sound City. She worked with Rick on the Johnny Cash thing there. She'd done Love Roller Coaster with the Chili Peppers there. And so we kind of knew, okay, yeah, a lot of people work here and there's some magic here. And she's going on about, oh, it's great. It's great. You know, she's, you know, she's a real excitable person. And, you know, that enthusiasm that she had was getting us excited about being there. So the first thing we saw was sort of like you cruise in, you know, you're like sort of like way out there, you know, in the valley. And we were staying in Hollywood. So it was like a big trek to go there every day. And I think we did the basic tracking there over the course of 2 to 3 weeks. So, you know, every day we're going up there. But when you walk in the door and you see those records, it kind of hits you like, oh, okay, there's some magic that's gone down in this room. But what was cool about the fact that it wasn't a super posh, fancy place was like, it was just more comfortable that way. It was just like
probably an immediate comfort. Yeah. Vibe happening, like, you know, just you felt right at home, maybe, or
it was a little homier, know? Yeah, and you know,
warm.
Like,
I think
I said the other night, like, you felt like you could just let your hair down, let it hang there, and you know, get to doing what you had to do, you know. So,
right, and at that time, I mean, what from that point in your career with Econoline Crush, what other studios have you recorded?
I recorded at The Warehouse, which was one of Brian Adams' studios up in Vancouver, a Little Mountain Sound, where all those, all the Motley Crues and Scorpions and all that kind of stuff was done up in Vancouver. Bob Rock and Bruce Fairburn and all those kind of guys that came out of Vancouver. So we'd been at a few of the different studios in Vancouver that, were a little bit more luxury on the surface end of things.
Right. So you had some other studios of reference, you know, just comparisons, like when you walked in, like, you know, I've worked here, I've worked there.
Well, when they show you in the movie where you see that like dirty old shag carpet that's in this, like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? It's just like, it's like way more like 70s disco. Felt like a place that had been like, you know, a lot of partying had gone down in there. Maybe not all of it cleaned up.
Yeah. There's still party looming and anchored to the shag carpet.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So when your band Econoline Crush recorded there, what studio were you in?
We did the basic tracks in the main room there. So they're probably called that Studio A.
Right.
There was another studio, Studio B, that we worked in as well, where Sylvia had her Neve console that was in Sound City. And we did a lot of guitar overdubs in there. And I remember actually when they were doing vocals or tracking some other stuff off of the big room. You know, I'd worked out some guitar melodies and things like that in Studio B. So we were around basically the whole sort of spread out. But when we were there also, I think Lenny Kravitz was doing a version of Dear Prudence with Chicago.
Wow.
Some sort of collaboration in the other room that's just, when you first walk through the door, there's another room that's before you walk all the way back to get to Studio A. So he was up there and, you know, so we were sort of bouncing between, once we finished the main tracks, we were bouncing between the main room and Studio B.
I mean, that sounds like, you know, kind of a treat. I mean, you guys are in this great studio and you're bouncing back and forth, you know, with to two different rooms at once while doing a record. So you kind of had like, you know, maybe if things were just getting, you know, a little on kind of cruise control in one room, you go into another room and it's a little more fresh maybe and you get rejuvenated. Would that happen at all? Or
you know what? To be honest, I can't really remember exactly why the logistics were the way they were. You know, some of it just seems more like snapshots. But yeah, it was exciting to be able to spread out there. And, you know, working there with Sylvia definitely felt like, you know, It was the most involved recording process that we'd been in, you know, up to that point.
Right. So when you tracked the record, you were using Sylvia's Neve board.
We used the one in A. We used hers, and we used the one in B and in A as well.
And the one that they bought.
Yes.
Okay.
The one that they bought.
Right. Now, talk about that. I mean, Todd, tell me about, what you can't remember.
Well,
just being in the moment on the spot, like when you were tracking and making your record, was it really hard to dial in the sound? Was it really?
No, she knew what was going on. I mean, it was her and a guy named Greg Fiddleman, who people may know now. You know, he's done,
I mean, huge records.
At the time, he was assisting and he was very confident. But she was real adventurous. I mean, she'd make us. I mean, I ended up using one of the main guitars I used wasn't mine. It was one of hers. And we tried all these different amps that she had. So it was just, you know, really going beyond the scope of, you know, what we would have done on our own. So, you know, that was an exciting part of getting to hear really, you know, because we did record it to tape. And, you know, that's where I first had that realization, where I really kind of realized the saturation and the warmth of the drum sounds hitting the tape and, you know,
right,
running everything through all that analog outboard gear and stuff.
That Sound City drum room and drum sound is so epic and legendary within the music industry, and what actually translates onto a record from that room, the way the drums project, etc. Like, do you have any memories of, like, you know, hearing the drums back for the first time? I mean, when you guys went in there, did you know it was a killer drum room? Did you already have reference on some of the records? Like, oh, you know, like...
No, we didn't. Like I said, we didn't really know anything about the studio. I mean, I wasn't like I was like... I mean, I own the records that are hanging on the wall. I mean, I have
right.
The Cellar and Holy Diver, but it wasn't like we were like, oh, wow, you know, it sounds just like Videopathy or something like that. But, you know, because what we were hearing was... everyone was really excited, and, you know, the rhythm section, I believe they burned through their stuff pretty quick. I mean, they were done in, you know, 2 days.
They were really prepared.
Something. Yeah, they were prepared. And
how many songs did you guys track there?
We did 12 songs, 11 or 12 songs.
And did they all make it onto the final product, or did you save a couple for B-sides?
Well, what happened in pre-production was there were different demos. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about going and making this record and was that she went through this list of demos, and, you know, I don't know if you've had this experience, but some of the songs on these demos that some of the guys had talked themselves out of by the time we got to making this record.
Right.
And what happened was, when she listened to the demos, you know, unbiased with fresh ears, she was like, oh no, this is in, you know, this song's in. And these guys are like, no, but, and she's like, no, this song's in, you better listen to it again. So, you know, it was like, it was cool to see that happen, because a couple of them, there was like five guys at the time. So
that's a lot of guys.
So
in
that, you have a swing vote in there, right? So
right.
It's not always like going to go down. You know, so you might not always get, you know, your choice of what's going on. So anyway, some of the stuff I'd totally even forgotten about, and it ended up being like the title track wasn't even being considered at that point. And it ended up being the title track of the album. And, you know, so little things like that were special. And so basically everything that we agreed on, everything that we were doing prior to entering the room. So when we were across the way in the rehearsals, with her, and then it was decided, okay, we're doing this, and this. And so that's how it went down.
Very cool.
So, you know, then you get your big chart on the wall, and,
yeah,
you know, everybody gets to put their X's in and finish it off.
That's great. Now, as far as the record goes, did you guys mix it there as well?
No, we didn't mix it there.
So it was a tracking experience only.
Yeah, it was... We really, you've got me thinking about this now, and I'm just like realizing how, you know, lucky we were at the time to be able, you know, because they're not really throwing money around at making records like that these days.
Right. There's not as much money available in the industry for advances to band, for just, you know, to get them on board, or for production.
Yeah. Because this record we tracked for, believe, up to 3 weeks there. Then we flew to Vancouver because it was the holidays, and she came up to Vancouver for a week and tracked more vocals and guitars in Vancouver. Then I think we had a break for a week or two. We flew back down here. We picked up some sessions at a place called Master Control out in the valley. We did like a little bit of guitar stuff with that we thought might have needed to happen before mix. And then we spent, I believe we spent up to 3 weeks at Larrabee West.
Oh, Larrabee West. Yeah. West Hollywood.
Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore, but it did at the time. And so we spent another 3 weeks mixing over there.
Right. Now, the other areas of the studio, I mean, like, you know, we're talking about a live room with, you know, with the console that Dave bought. What about the other parts of the studio? I mean, like, was there, you know, just a simple lounge area? Was there, you know, the kitchen? I mean, was that just like really homely as well, where you just felt really comfortable, where you could become a part of the facility and like, just, you know, go right back into your work?
I believe there was like a room that had a couch with a TV that was off of the kitchen or before the kitchen. Because there's like this long hallway to get down to this like dirty kitchen.
Sure.
And, you know, just, you know, you would run into the people from other sessions there when they were breaking, or if you're eating or whatever. But, you know, it was pretty bare. I don't know. It was pretty bare bones. It wasn't.
Well, no frills, right?
No frills.
Maybe that's why all the magic happened.
No frills.
People were actually working.
No frills over there. Yeah. You know, I didn't. Yeah, there wasn't like people playing video games or anything like that when we were there. But there was like maybe a closet off the front where Fiddleman, I remember Fiddleman was kind of bouncing around too, where he was like maybe editing Bruce Dickinson's album at the time.
That's cool. He worked at Fiddleman back then, because I mean, since then, I mean, he's worked with Slayer and Metallica, right, in the last two records.
Yeah, I don't think it gets much bigger in metal or rock than that these days, right?
Yeah, so, it's pretty much the...
And he's such an easygoing guy. I mean, it was like, it's weird. Like, if you go do a record in Vancouver, you know, if you even move one of your volume knobs or your tone knob, or you like, you know, when you just do anything, there's an engineer there with like a notebook. And at the end of the session, they hand you this binder so they can do complete total recalls. When we were over at Sound City, there's nothing like that going down.
It was pretty loose.
Yeah, it was pretty loose. Like,
wow.
Like, you know, it would have to be, you know, if they're going to do things like that, it would have to be off the, you know, their memory, I guess. So it was like real loose. And I think that attributed to, you know, a lot of the performance that went down and a lot of the magic that happened there.
So another question I have is, in the movie, they talk about the Budweiser factory right by there and how the smell would just penetrate the studio. Did you ever get hindered by that at all?
You know, I have a bad sense of smell. So when I saw that part in the movie, I didn't really remember that. But, you know, yeah, I'm sure, like, we did. But
obviously remember the building. But
yeah.
You don't remember, like, you know.
I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember. Like, really, I would be shuttled in there in a van, and then I would, you know, go into the studio and wouldn't really
Major
come out until it was time to, like, be shuttled back out.
Major label style, right?
Yeah, so I didn't really, like, well, no, it was just, you know, I wasn't driving at the time.
Right.
Like, I wasn't the driver of the van that the band had or whatever. So I
was,
like,
waiting for a ride. And
yeah, so I wasn't out sniffing the beer, the Budweiser beer factory. But I'm sure if they say it stunk and it was there, then I'm sure it was.
Right. So when they were putting this movie together, Dave's people, you were actually contacted at one point for photos, right?
Yeah, one of their production, some woman contacted me about whether I had any photographs. And, you know, I just kind of said, you know, have you talked to Sylvia? Which, of course, she had, because at the time, you know, this was 96. It was sort of pre-digital, obviously there were computers and laptops and stuff, but it wasn't really at the level where everybody was rolling with the internet. And, you know, I remember going into a hotel room with one of our guys who had a laptop at the time, and he's like, yeah, man, I got this thing, the internet. It was like, he had some Mac, you know, portable Mac that was like black and white or something, and it took, you know, you plugged it into the phone line and it took forever to even load up a picture, you know, and it was, you know, the resolution was, you know, it was just archaic. And so I didn't take any pictures at the time, although Sylvia is known for logging. She would take these Polaroids of all of her sessions, and she had like this big collection of Polaroids, and she'd do this thing where she like would take a picture of you and then heat it up with a lighter to a certain point without burning it. And then she would like write with a pen over top of it. And
really,
it would like cause these crazy effects. I think you can.
That sounds like an Instagram filter now.
Yeah.
You know, like now you'd have to like just hit a button on Instagram.
Yeah. It was really interesting to see how she did this. It was real artistic. And I believe, you know, if you look her up online or you go to her studio's website, I believe you can see some of those photographs, or if you find her on Facebook or something. She has a collection, so, you know, you can see all the different sessions that she did, and, you know, Johnny Cash or Maynard or Tool or, you know, all kinds of different people.
Right. Now tell me this. Okay, so fast forward present day, the movie comes out, you go see it, you've worked there, and tell me about your perspective, someone who's worked there in that room with the board that they have bought. And now, you know, they're highlighting all these acts that have worked there as well. Was there anything, like any little fun facts that you didn't know that you learned from the movie? Was there a lot of new information, or was it more of just kind of a...
Well, it was interesting to see the real history of it, the way that, you know, the way they wanted to tell it. You know, the whole Buckingham Nicks thing and, You know, I didn't really know at the time that the studio had fallen on hard times.
Same,
just
yeah.
prior to that. So we were kind of like one of those bands, I guess.
After Nirvana.
It was like after Nirvana.
96, you came in, right?
Yeah, where, you know, I guess if you pay attention to why things were the way they were at the time, you know, there's a lot of bands getting signed because there's a lot of money from CD sales out there, you know.
Right.
So everybody had a lot of money to do things. Anyway, I didn't really realize that. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I thought the story was really well told, and I could totally relate to the experience because, you know, I guess he's right. You know, they put together the movie because he's like, hey, I really wouldn't. I kind of got the sense of like where he's like, he felt like he owed, like he's like, if it wasn't for this board, maybe, you know, some of the magic wouldn't have happened the way it went down for them.
Yeah, it changed his whole life.
Did you get that off?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What I got was like, you know, obviously, you know, recording there on that board for the Nevermind sessions, and then Nevermind going on to do what it did and snowballing into, you know, all the other records and a full career for Nirvana at a stardom level, you know, that.
Yeah, see, when I watched the movie, I kind of got that. I mean, we put out our record up in Canada and it became a platinum selling album up there. So, you know.
The record you did, it was actually a platinum selling record in Canada.
In Canada, yeah, not here, but like,
the one
so
you
we
did
had,
Sound City.
Yeah, so we had success off of it. We had, you know, it was like that record for us. You know what I mean?
And you did it at Sound City.
And we did it at Sound City.
So you see, I mean, where's that magic?
So when I saw the movie and I hear about this, I'm like, well, of course. Like, you know, there was no debating in my mind what they were probably going to be talking about. And when I watched the movie, I'm like, yeah, of course. Uh-huh. Yes. Like, it just sort of co-signed what I already felt. And, you know, it was exciting to see. You know, like, for me, the first part of the movie seemed like they're talking about Sound City, but then the second half is where they kind of get into the human element of like, of recording and like, you know, this is an, cause they were kind of, I hadn't really thought about this. Maybe this is, you know, tying into what you were talking about. They were hinting at like, there's a lot of people that may never have an experience like this recording.
Very true. I think, that's the next part of, you know, the talk I want to get in with you. It's funny we go into that pretty seamlessly because, you know, that second half of the movie, they talk about the tradition of musicians and engineers and producers and people involved in recording, interacting and connecting to one another, you know, on a human-to-human basis.
Yeah.
Which seems like, you know, from, I remember, you know, recording at Energy Studios and, you know, for the record in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, picking up the phone and talking to someone to, you know, to record, to actually record or, you know, to book a session and then go down there to see it. And then, you know, just all these communication skills involved before you get in there. And now it's like, you know, you just pop open your laptop and, you know, get your plugins, you know, you pull your plugins up and you start recording away. And it's very much an isolationist aesthetic.
Yeah.
No matter what kind of music you're doing. But not saying that everyone is records like that, but it just seems like there's a lot of music in all genres that have an approach where you just do it in your house by yourself, or you maybe have a few musician friends to get it together. But I think the way they talked about, you know, how the industry is flooded with a lot of people with home studios and other artists that, you know, actually sing out of tune but are put in tune with pitch perfect software.
Yeah.
Kind of makes you scratch your head. And the one highlight of that segment is when Dave and Trent Reznor say, you know, technology's gotten really good, but new music hasn't.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah.
It was, I mean, yeah, getting back to the movie and this human element, you know, the part where Paul McCartney and him are tracking.
Yes.
Okay, so they show them that Paul McCartney comes in off the cuff. And see, for me, I just heard that Paul McCartney track on the radio or on television. I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. But then I didn't realize the movie opened my eyes to how that went down. And, you know, he just shows up, he's playing guitar, they start jamming, and they made the song off the cuff. And then I was like, oh, this is cool.
Right.
And then they go and they listen back and they're like working things out. Hey, why don't we try this vocal harmony, this and that. They go in and Dave looks over at him and goes, man, why can't it always be this easy? And Paul McCartney looks at him and goes, it is.
Yeah.
And I just, that totally resonated with me because, you know, this past year I'd been doing some recordings analog and working with different people and I just got what he said. I was just like, you don't have to overthink it. You don't have to, they weren't suffering from a Pro Tools disease. It seemed like everything was really immediate and I think like what you were talking about with the isolation, yeah, a lot of people are missing, you know, they're missing things. You know, when you listen to older recordings, like, what's different about this? You know, the technically this sounds great and monstrous and this and that, but like, what's going on here? Well, what's going on there is a group of people, you know, maybe in the 70s or the 60s or
right, whatever. Even in the 80s.
In the 80s. Yeah, it's not to say there's not people that do that, but if you're looking at like, you know, on there's just a lot of people also being isolated these days. But I think that there's, you know, I'd recently gone and bought some tape up in the valley from a place that supplies the tape for the tape machines for the 1-inch and 2-inch. And they said they can't keep tape in these days. So I think that there is some sort of mindset that's going back to analog.
Sure.
Or in conjunction with, you know, so.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of people are just stopping in their tracks and they're asking themselves, you know, vinyl or CD, you know, recording analog or Pro Tools or Cubase or GarageBand or whatever it is. You know, and I think that if they could, you know, there's people out there that care enough to try to go out of their way and do things the way they want that are, that, you know, that very organic and I don't want to say traditional, but just, you know, just the way things are done, see it through. You know, we're going to record this live. It's going to be the tape, you know, on an Eve board.
Yeah.
And then when we're done, we're going to make vinyl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a total analog. I guess it's an analog subculture.
Yes.
Does that sound right? Like well, a I think way
you,
to put it?
You just coined it. You just coined it.
Yeah. I'll call my intellectual property lawyer right now.
Yeah.
No, but anyways, yeah, so that was what really, you know, really like drove it home for me with Sound City. The fact that not only did they do great work with the interviews and, I'm not sure if you heard Jim's, James wrote his episode last Monday, 2 days ago, but you know, he was saying they did 52 interviews altogether.
Yeah. Just prior to when I spoke, I heard he's like, well then, you know, how do you break it down? Because everyone that they is like, all of a sudden they had all these cool people that got back to them about doing it. So they had to sort of like thin the herd a bit.
Exactly. And it just seemed like, you know, for the first half, they had all these interviews that were just pretty much, you know, based on the history of it and who worked there and how things were done. But then, you know, then it touched on some career paths, like Rick Springfield. He talked about his affiliation with the owner, and there was a management situation. So it kind of like highlighted, you know, these, you know, what I like to call fun facts that maybe you wouldn't know was actually happening coming out of that facility. It was more than just a studio. It was actually, you know, a catalyst for a lot of people.
Well, it was interesting also, you kind of took me back into the movie there a little bit, where Keith Olsen, who was one of the original guys at the studio, you know, who worked with Fleetwood Mac, who ends up going and working on Whitesnakes and Billy Idols and all this, how he went all digital in the 80s and actually broke away from the studio because of the way that the studio was doing things.
So sure.
It's kind of interesting now to see where people are starting to find a balance between the two, you know, or not just choosing one over the other.
Yeah, and the fact that, like I said, and you know, during the second half when they really make that transparent, you know, framework of like, not only are these studios going away, but people aren't going to be experiencing that whole experience where you actually go into a place like this where there's been so much history and there's so much magic lingering in these rooms. You know what I mean?
Yes.
With the work that's been done there. And, you know, if you really tap into it, it's just kind of like you could really take a part of that, you know, to your project and just experience working on different, you know, analog machines and actually trying to work, you know, a little creatively on a sound, like a drum room, you know?
Yes.
Like Dave was saying, every room has a sweet spot.
Yeah.
Right? And you got to find that.
I think a lot of people that, you know, a lot of musicians or people who don't know they're musicians yet who will eventually be, I think if they see this movie, they'll walk away inspired on some level, you know, or intrigued at the very least. You know, if they aren't doing things that way, perhaps they'll, you know, try to, you know, I don't know. I kind of got, you know, I got a charge off of seeing it and, you know, I've already done a lot of this kind of stuff and I continue to, You know, so you know, the consensus that I got from people I know is that, you know, they thought it was good as well. Maybe some people missed the boat. They missed the point of the last bit. But I thought, man, to make a movie out of, you know, a recording console and make it interesting for 2 hours and make it make sense and all that was quite a feat.
Right. And I think a good word to describe that last half of the movie that we've been talking about is, you know, just the intuitive part of making music and connecting with people and recording. It's kind of like, you know, you go into a room, you look for that sweet spot. You intuitively, you know, will put your drums in an area and you know, set up all the mics and, you know, try to get sounds there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And mess around with the you know, all the makeshift, what do they call those? The things on rollers that muffle the sound.
Oh, the baffles.
Yeah, the baffles and all that. And you know, putting the blankets on the drums and...
Well, I think, yeah, that was interesting. I mean, you know, looking at Sound City, for instance, you know, which maybe even may, you know, translate to people thinking, you know, they, you know, the one guy was like, technically this room shouldn't fucking sound as good as it does.
Right.
So basically, if you're out there at home and you have some microphones and this and that, you know what I mean? Like, you can make all kinds of spaces rock. So,
yeah. And I think just with, you know, some passion and some intuitive know-how and just a will to do things, you can make it work anywhere.
Exactly.
Really. I think that's the sole message. Now, switching to another part of Sound City, I want to talk to you about the live show because you were there.
Yes.
You saw the live show. Now, what was your take on that? I mean, personally, you know, I was there and I thought it was just, you know, really...
I was really blown away.
I was floored. That's the one word, floored.
To see, you know, everything from Stevie Nicks with Dave Grohl to leaving, you know, being backed by the Foo Fighters.
Pat Smear,
yeah.
A drum guitarist playing with Fear.
And it all was badass. I mean, Rick Springfield came out and it was just like, you know, whatever, it was, you know, people were losing it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's another...
There was a person in front of me crying.
Really?
Crying. He wasn't crying over Rick Springfield, but I think he's like that much into Dave Grohl that he was like crying that he was there experiencing it. It was a... You know, people were really excited about it, and they did a really good job wrangling that all together.
Yeah, I mean, that's another admirable accomplishment I think Dave pulled off. I mean, not only did he pull 2 hours out of this board, and it was interesting, but actually put together these live shows to promote the movie and got everyone involved.
Yeah, and they played where? Like, they played at Sundance, they played here, played New York.
Well, went in London, right?
Did it play in London as well?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, personally for me, I mean, to see, you know, like, you know, Leaving, Fear, and, you know...
Rick Nielsen,
Fogerty. I've never seen Fogerty. I've never seen Cheap Trick. I just felt I was just immersed in greatness.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to leave. And it was a long show. It was about 4 hours long, wasn't it?
It was long.
Wasn't it about 4 hours?
Yes, it was almost, I think, well, I left just before 1 o'clock, so whatever time they started.
I think they started playing at 8:30.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a 4 hour show.
It was long. And then, you know, it's just like, yes, and I don't have anything bad to say about the show. I don't have anything bad to say about the movie. The movie was inspiring. The show was inspiring, but I guess that also shows how all these different people can come together and interact and bring everything to like a higher level. I think all of those people, it looked like from all of these collaborations that had gone on, they've all sort of personally come to some different heights in their careers and things as far as being able to go, you know, for Dave and those guys to go play those 4 or 5 Rick Springfield songs and then to rock out with Fear. It was just like, you know, and to be a part of it and witness it and it sound, you know, just, you know, what can I say about it? I guess it's just like that extra magic. You know, if you get a chance to see the show, because I believe I heard they may be doing more of them.
Right. And there's a record out.
Oh, there's a record out too.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. So, like a soundtrack that was all recorded at Dave's.
So if you can't get enough of the movie.
Right. No, I mean, it's great because the movie's so great. It's inspiring. You know, it shows you, you know, a clear vision of how it all went down in Sound City throughout the days, you know, from inception of the business to where it's at now. And then, you know, it talks about the history with, you know, Fleetwood Mac being like the first catalyst to push it through. And then,
well, and the magic of like, if he didn't, you know, have that guy, you know, Mick Fleetwood. Yeah. Mick Fleetwood didn't have that hustler in his, you know, in his ear going, hey, come check out the studio. They roll down there and that serendipitous sort of, you know, meeting where he overhears the Buckingham Nicks record being played over the console. Like, hey, check this out. You know, that we may have never had that Fleetwood Mac.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's really, I guess you call that a determinism.
Yeah.
That's the term.
Yeah.
You know, where you just like, you know, if it wasn't for this person that led you here, you know, it's all determinism.
So, you know, it's kind of like that studio was sort of a crossroads for a lot of different people at a lot of different points in their careers. And some of them came back and some of them went on to do other things.
Right.
But it was just, it's one of those kind of places. And there's other vortexes like that, I guess. That
yeah, sure. Read.
But,
sure.
You know, it was great to see, you know, him give back where he hears, hey, you know, the studio's going to be done, you know, that it's just, you know, you need to kind of get involved.
One thing I was blown away by was, and I asked James Rhoda about this on Monday, was I wish there was more Rat interview, and I wish they would have been a part of the live show.
Dude,
imagine a Foo Fighters playing the Out of the Cellar record.
Yeah, that's what I, you know, that was the part, you know, if that was like my little thing. I was just like, man, if Stephen Piercy would have come out and played like Round and Round with them.
Or
like,
Back for More back with for Foo Fighters. I would have flipped out.
Yeah.
Like right there at the police.
You know, or those guys or somebody comes out and plays Holy Diver or Rainbow in the Dark or Stand Up and Shout. Then I just would have been like, what the hell?
Exactly.
But, you know, I think they covered a lot of territory. And like you said, it was hard to even cover what they did, I'm sure.
You absolutely. Know. You know what I want to do is I want to go back to the record you made there. And I want to talk about, you know, you had a platinum selling success in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the record was recorded at, your record
yes.
was recorded at Sound City in yes. 1996. And it was commercially released in 97 or 8?
97, it was released in Canada. And then 98, it was released in the United States.
Right, now it's through EMI Canada, correct?
EMI in Canada and Restless in the U.S.
Right. And what did you do as far as your touring cycle on that?
We toured a lot. Got back and we were waiting for the album to win. This is when we were waiting for the album to come out. It hadn't dropped yet. Maybe one of the videos, you know how they set the records up where they play video or release a song to the radio. But we, I get a call from Trevor one day. I think this was around, because we'd done the album. We started doing the album, I think we ended up doing most of it in December. You know, in and then it trailed into January in Vancouver and then February. So by March, I think it was March, we're done the album. It's in the can. I'm in Vancouver hanging out at one of my friend's places. I get this call. Hey, bro, better sit down.
That's how it went down?
Yeah, and it's like at this point.
Hey, bro, better sit down.
Yeah, he's like, at this point, we'd actually secured our management. Because like I said earlier in the today, it was like we're at a crossroads where we didn't know who was doing the album, who was managing us. So, you know, this guy, Bruce Allen, ended up managing us. And he was able to put this, you know, one of his, you know, he's pretty involved in a lot of different things. And we get this opportunity to open for Kiss for, you know, the week that they were going to come across Canada. During the reunion tour.
Wow.
And so, you know, it seemed like you go do this record that you're all excited about and this magic, and then all of a sudden you're getting calls like, hey, man, you're going to be on the front end opening for Kiss.
I mean, huge venues.
Yeah, right? Yeah, this was in the arenas, you know, so it was like, you know, we drive out to Winnipeg and started up with them in Winnipeg and then did six shows across Western Canada with them on that tour. And then, you know, we end up going and doing all this club touring. We end up going and doing that summer. We did a big tour with Foo Fighters and Green Day and a bunch of other bands on some big festival. And, you know, later it just keeps rolling. We go on a tour with a few other bands from Canada that are big. You know, we're constantly playing sold out shows.
Wow.
And, you know, we get into the next year and we're still touring because the United States releases the album. So we're down here touring and touring wow. and touring. And then near the end of 98, we get a call, hey, you're going on tour with Kiss again. So it was like this Kiss thing kept
happening.
So it was like, you know, when we go back in your mind now and you attribute, you know, like he's gone. You see Dave Grohl getting excited about the board and what happened to him.
Yeah.
From that experience at Sound City. When I go back to it, it's like, man, I would have never toured with Kiss. I would have never toured with Foo Fighters,
Green Day. Yeah, it snowballs into all these positive things that push you through.
Yeah, like sitting there, focusing, harnessing, whatever it was that we were all putting into, the sounds that were being captured on tape. And then once it gets, once it gets mixed and released, it takes on a whole nother life and all kinds of other magic starts flowing through the universe. And it's...
Yeah. So let me ask you something. Not everyone gets to be in Kiss world. So when you're actually playing your first show with Kiss and you're sharing the stage with them, I mean, you're a pro. I mean, but did that little kid inside you get excited?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you looking at the stage like behind you and stuff?
Well, sink or swim, man, at that point, right? It's right. Like you're playing, we played some big shows, but not like that. I mean, you go, we drive into the arena, you walk out of your bus or whatever, and you hear like Ace Frehley jamming Cream, from his sound check, and all of a sudden it starts to sink in. Like, and then it sinks into me like how many people even more so that I knew or grew up with, like it all just sort of washes over me. Like, you know how many guys would just die right now?
Right.
So whatever, then you got to go do your sound check or whatever. And I go up there and it's like, I'm on Gene Simmons' side of the stage. And there's his microphone with all his picks. Oh, there's his monitor. Oh, we have full access to what they've given us here. Oh, I can put my foot on Gene Simmons' monitor. It's like, you're in Kiss world. It's
totally like, Kiss world. Like, when you're an opening act for a band like that or for a Kiss, I mean, are there a lot of rules?
Yeah, there were some rules, but I mean, why would, of course there's rules, right?
Because there's chaos if there's no rules.
Yeah, if there's no rules, I mean, it's not our house, it's our house.
Yeah, that's true.
There are rules. I mean, I think when they were working out certain songs that may or may not have been in the set or were in the set or pulled out of the set when they were rehearsing them, I think there was like kind of like a, hey, maybe not be like watching.
Right.
Don't be, don't speak unless spoken to, that kind of thing.
So pretty cut and dry. Like,
yeah. And that's not to say that they weren't friendly.
Because you did spend some time with them.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was all good, right?
It's all good.
Awesome. So let's plug the record that you recorded at Sound City. Econoline Crush, what's the title?
It's called The Devil You Know.
And that's available on iTunes?
It's available on iTunes, yes.
Cool. So everyone that's listening, download it on iTunes or I guess... If it's at iTunes, it's at Amazon as well?
It's at Amazon.
And what's the Econoline Crush website?
It's econolinecrush.us or econolinecrush.ca. Both of them go to the same place.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. We're going to take a break. We're going to play some tracks that are courtesy of our soundboard engineer. He's going to pick and play whatever he wants. And he's got a good, we're talking about intuitive skills and... how to keep things going, keep the ball rolling. So we're going to let him play a few tracks and we're going to take a little break and come back and get into some classic Los Angeles Nista format with places to go, people to see, buses to ride, subways to take. And I think we're going to let you hear a few songs and we'll be back. Thanks.
Wrap right around my throat. I am wrapped up.
All right. Welcome back to Los Angeles, Nista. We're taking calls 1-800-893-9562. My in-studio guest, Robert Morfitt of Econoline Crush, one of the alumni of Sound City Studios. Last Monday, we had James Rhoda, the producer from Sound City. And when I say the producer, this the producer of the movie, Dave Grohl's flick.
Yeah.
And Robert actually recorded a record there. And this is the second Sound City installment. So, Robert, thanks again for having having us in your schedule.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Cool. So, you know, everyone's familiar with Los Angeles Nissan. That we talk about the guests the first hour and get into the classic Los Angeles Nista format on the second hour, which is, you know, geography, places you like to go, and public transportation.
Public transportation. I use public transportation when I go to Kings games.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? You go to a lot of hockey games with your girlfriend, right?
Yes.
And it seems like the way to do things, if you're going to get from like the Valley or Hollywood to downtown LA Live, you want to, take the red line.
Well, yeah, it's really convenient. It's really easy. You know, it just park the car at the North Hollywood station and just get on and, you know, 20 minutes later or however long it is, you're down at LA Live.
Exactly. From my experiences, I mean, I always like to get people excited, inspired, and in a new routine to take public transportation to an event like that, because with the red line and blue line so close to Staples Center and all the LA Live venues, there's no reason to drive your car in traffic.
Well, some of my friends, I mean, I'm not speaking about myself because I lead a different lifestyle these days, but some of my friends like to enjoy the hockey game. And the way they like to enjoy the hockey game is having a few beverages.
Right.
Hey, you know what? You don't need to drive to Staples Center. You know what I mean? Hop on the red line, get down there safely, get home safely, enjoy the game as much as you want, and, you know, everyone wins.
Right. I mean, and parking is anywhere from $5 to $25.
Sure. Well, of course, you skirt that, and, you know, you may... Who knows? Maybe you're going to see part of the city you didn't get to see. You know, it's kind of, they've built up the area nicely down there now. And, you know, it's really no sweat to take the public transit down there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, from my experience, you know, going to a lot of Clipper games, Laker games, and, you know, concerts like The Who and Van Halen. A lot of times, I mean, if you're coming from, you know, the Valley, you could definitely just drive in to the North Hollywood Red Line station off Lancashire. You can park your car for free.
Yes.
You know, you get out the old tap card, you load it for $5.
Yes.
That's a day pass. And you know what? I mean, you could get from the North Hollywood station to, 7th and Metro in 18 minutes.
18 minutes, yeah.
17, 18 minutes. And then you go
well,
up.
That's usually what, I usually walk from there.
See, I just walk, 10 minutes?
Not even. Well, no. I guess it's 10 minutes. It doesn't really feel very long.
No, I mean, but I'm talking by the time you get to the front door of Staples Center.
Sure, of course, yes.
Yeah, and it's a 10-minute walk, and you just, you know, like Robert said, you just skirted the gas.
Yeah, you skirted the gas.
And the 10, 15, 20 bucks to park.
Yeah, and you know how they get about the parking down there.
Right, and if it's someone that wants to actually enjoy the show, whether it's a concert or a sporting event, and you actually want to drink... You're not drinking and driving, so you're promoting safe ways of travel, and you're going green by not, you know...
You're being responsible for yourself and others.
Exactly. So,
whoa,
yeah,
what a concept.
Whoa. So all of a sudden, you're like, you care. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
whoa, I didn't realize that. Take the red line because you care.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it could definitely be a very helpful tool for everybody out there. And then, you know, you're not going to, you know, get an accident. And, you know, when you're walking, you lose a little weight.
Yes.
So it gets pretty, there's more pros than cons, put
man,
it that way.
Man, because you care about yourself, you're getting exercise.
Yeah. And guess what? When you're driving, you can't text or email, even though people do it and it's dangerous.
Well, you can't really text and email on the red line yet.
But you can.
You can.
Because
do they have Wi-Fi now?
No, but what you could do on the red line station is you could actually, what I do when I'm on the red line train coming from Hollywood or North Hollywood to downtown is I open up my phone, my Gmail application, and I write emails.
Sure, and log them until you get off.
And then when I go upstairs,
boom,
it's just a zap, 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 zap out into cyberspace. So that's, you know, that's one of...
It It would be cool if they had Wi-Fi on it. I know. I rode some public transit in Europe this past summer.
Okay.
And there was Wi-Fi on the train, I think in Oslo. In Oslo. I know it's far from here, but next step for LA.
You know what the next step for LA is the subway to the sea.
Yes.
That's the next step. Mm-hmm. I think so.
It's getting close.
Right. So how long have you lived in Los Angeles?
I've lived in Los Angeles for a year and a half now.
Okay, let's talk about food places. By Red Line stops.
Oh, by Red Line stops?
Hollywood and Western.
Okay, well, there's the Rincon.
Yeah. You know what? I love your translation of that because, like, that's how I am with even though I'm Mexican, even with Mexican food places. I just, like, if I'm too lazy to say a word,
yeah,
I'll just call it something else.
Oh,
like, I called Tecates Tectates. You know what I mean? I'm just like, I got some Tectates. Let's go for it. Because it looks like it says Tectates.
Well, what is it actually? What I was trying to say? I don't know.
Tecates.
Oh, Tecate. It is Tecates.
Yeah.
But it's like, it does say Rincon on the...
Yeah, but it's called Oaxacan Rincon.
Oh, Oaxacan Rincon.
But it's, Rincon.
Rincon.
It sounds like the new Chuck Norris movie.
It'll beat me, beat me.
Yeah. Jeez. So you know what? I mean...
By stations, huh?
Yeah, I know. So here's the first one.
Oh.
Okay, so...
This is like a quiz now.
So for our listeners and people that are going to, you know, hear the podcast later tonight...
Yes.
You know, Robert and I have gone over the level of just feeding ourselves. I think we're like in foodie blog mode here where we could actually tell you where to go get the best Mexican food that's fresh and cheap in Hollywood. And it's no touristy trap... Okay, it's Oaxacan Rincon.
Yes.
Right? That's the southeast corner of Hollywood and Western.
Yes.
On Western between Sunset and Hollywood. Now, some of the people out there that haven't experienced a lot of Mexican food, you know, maybe you watch Rick Bayless on the Live Well Network. He's actually great when it comes to explaining why the sauces are darker because this is a regional, dish. You know, like,
yes.
Like, for instance, like when I saw you had the mole at the Oaxacan Rincon, the mole sauce.
Molanos.
Yeah. Well, you had some mole stuff too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The the sauce is so much darker. Like it's black.
Yes, it's black.
With white rice. Now, in an East LA restaurant, it's brown. It's like a light coffee brown.
And why is that?
Well, it's just region.
Yeah.
It's just because they use more like darker chocolate in Oaxaca. And the rice, you know, is orange Spanish rice here, but there they actually use white rice. And when you get a mixture of maybe a burrito from that place, Oaxacan Rincon, they put a lot of, say like a veggie burrito would be white rice with beans, big peppers, like a saute.
Yes.
You know, red and big onions, which versus out here, it would be chopped little, you know, onions and cilantro and, you know,
so
tomato.
A few stations away and everything changes.
Yeah. So I'm just saying from my experience, if you're looking for really good Mexican food in Hollywood, I'm focusing on this spot here because we've both been there. We've both been there without each other.
I've gone without you. I'm sorry.
Please don't do that again.
It had to happen.
I beg you. No, but...
Well, I see. I like to go to Union Station.
Okay.
And get mole over on Elvira Street.
Right. Well, here's what's cool.
But now knowing that there's a place that's a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And a little bit cheaper.
Right. But here's the public transportation message for everyone.
Yes.
If you're into suburbs... Whether it's like, you know, if you're out in North Hollywood or the Valley, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you want to go experience Oaxacan Rincon at Hollywood and Western.
Yes.
You would just get yourself, you know, take the bus or the car or bike to the Hollywood, North Hollywood, Lancashire Red Line Station.
Yes.
Get on the platform that says to Union Station, get off on Hollywood and Western. And you just walk south on Western on the east side of the street. It's awesome because... not only is her food so delicious and so real and so fresh, they give you big portions.
Yeah.
And the price is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's like East LA prices. It doesn't feel like you're in Hollywood.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like you're in Hollywood and you're right in Hollywood.
And I'm convinced a lot of people don't know about this place because every time I go, it's just a handful of people.
No, you know what? When I went there without you, I think I went without you twice, actually.
Right.
Sorry.
It's okay.
And there's actually a lot of people hanging out there. There's people doing schoolwork there. There's people, there's a younger crowd, mixed crowd. And it seems like there's people that are in the know that that place exists.
Okay, so.
But it's not like overrun. Right.
It's not like, what's a place on Hollywood Boulevard, the Loteria or the,
Yeah, places I don't go.
Yeah, there's, the places where the amateurs go.
Yeah.
There's no amateurs at Oaxaca and Rincon.
No.
So the funny thing is a lot of people.
You want to go pro.
Yeah, we're pros, man. we do this shit all the time. So anyways, we have I have a little secret.
Yes.
Summer nights and spring nights at Oaxaca and Rincon are amazing because they got the waterfall outside. They got the patio lights, like the little holiday lights. And then they got the taco guy outside. And it's like street meat style, like in East Los. Like he's out there with the big the big piece of meat hanging down. And he's just like, oh, you want four tacos? Yeah, I'll make them like fresh right there.
Yeah.
So like you could maybe order a dinner with someone. And then like maybe you just want if you're into beers or they have really good horchata. Their horchata, see, that's another... another presentation that the Oaxacan cuisine changes. When you buy it out here in Los Angeles, which is very Mexico City-esque, it's like very, it's just all white with a little bit of brown cinnamon. This actually has walnuts. It's the horchata with the cinnamon with like a red syrup, kind of like a topping. With the walnuts and the pineapple.
Yeah, when I was there, I didn't try the horchata, but I tried the... It was kind of like a champurrado.
The hot chocolate.
A hot chocolate. And it was one of the best hot chocolates that I've ever had in my life.
Right. So another thing that is great about them, like I was saying, was, if you're going to a gig or a show in Hollywood, it's a great place to stop off in the evening before that show because not only can you say if you want to get there from downtown, you just take the red line all the way, get off Hollywood and Western, right?
Yeah.
It's the ambiance is amazing. I mean, you're out there. You're in the middle of Hollywood, you're eating $2 tacos, $5 burritos, and it's like really mind-boggling how good the food is, how big it is, and the atmosphere and the location of the city.
Speaking of going there just prior to gigs, I went there just prior to the Bronx show that was over.
Oh.
Because it was logistically on the path.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So as far as the topic of Mexican food.
Yes.
Tell me about other places you like.
For Mexican food, well, I'm not sure. I like to go to the place on Overa Street when I can get down there for the mole. I think that the mole there at Las Golondrinas is like some of the best mole I've ever tried. And, the Oaxacan place. I'm trying to think of where else I go for Mexican food.
You know what I like?
What's that?
That I'll turn you on to is in Boyle Heights, there's a little square called Mariachi Square Plaza. And if you were to take, I would say, the red line to Union Station.
Yes.
And the gold line to East Los Angeles, you would get off at Mariachi Square Plaza stop. And what would happen is you'd go across street and you would see a place called the M Bar. The M Bar on Tuesday nights has $2 Tuesdays. Now, if you're into drinking, then it's like, okay, it may be, more of a appealing thing for someone.
So does $2 Tuesday translate to the beverages as well as the food?
Yeah, $2 imports, right? You also have $2 quesadillas.
So it's a win-win.
$2 tacos. I think it's like two tacos for $2. And it's just really cool because spring and summer, it's baseball season. I mean, it's just a nice... What I would call a pop-in visit place, like before a ball game or or before a concert or a show, because with that Metro Tap card, $5, it's unlimited, and it's literally footsteps from the Gold Line station. So if you were say you wanted to go to a Dodger game, right?
Yes.
And say like you lift off for you was North Hollywood Station.
Yes.
Or Red Line. You would take the Red Line south to Union Station. You would get on the Gold Line, go two or three stops to Mariachi Square Plaza, come to the Surface Street level, go across street to M Bar. You would get the $2 Tuesday, maybe hang out 30 minutes, half hour, see some different scenery, right? In the old historic Mariachi Square Plaza, get back on the Gold Line, go to Union Station and take the shuttle to the Dodger Stadium.
Dude, I'm sold. I think this is happening soon.
Sounds good, right?
Yes, it does. You've mapped it all out for me.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. I'm just connecting the dots in my head and just speaking, sharing the information.
Yeah. No, it's great. I mean, I've been using the subway more and more, so you know, I'm planning on I've been riding my bike actually, and I've been going along the river. And last weekend I went from Burbank to Atwater Village.
Very cool.
But I've been meaning to ride over to Eagle Rock, and what I think I'm going to do actually is take the Gold Line. I'm going to ride the bike to the Gold Line.
Yep.
Put the bike on the Gold Line, go up to Pasadena.
Okay.
And do some riding around Pasadena, because I think to get from Burbank to Pasadena, there's not really a good direct bike route. But by taking the Gold Line, you know, I can just get right up in there.
You know, to be completely honest with you, I would say right now, with all the existing train lines and rail lines that the MTA has to offer, the Red Line, the Blue Line, the Green Line, Purple, and the Gold. The Gold is the most scenic and the most therapeutic. Yeah.
So if you need to chill out, you need to just get away within the city itself.
Listen, if things were falling apart, all you got to do is spend $150 on a one-way ticket from one side of the line to the other. It could be from East Los Angeles to Sierra Madre. And the reason why is because the Gold Line train is mostly above ground.
Ah.
It's not underground. Now, when you take the Blue Line, you know, there's not so many nice things to see. Let's be honest, you know.
Yeah.
When you go from downtown to Long Beach, to downtown Long Beach, you know, it's kind of rough around the edges. So there's not a lot of eye candy as far as geography and buildings and, you know, hills and nice things.
So if you're not feeling good, don't take the Blue Line is what you're saying?
No, because things will fall apart.
Things will. When you get to Long Beach, it's over.
Yeah, yeah. No, but to be honest with you, when you take that Gold Line, you know, ride from downtown and you want to take it, say, to Pasadena, I mean, you go through East LA and it's funny because all the streets, like it feels like you're on like a train at Knott's Berry Farm.
Is winding
it's just kind of like slow and it's like a busy street, but it's like a residential kind of speed. And you just see all these old, you know, these old bars and tamale places. And you see the community supermarket, the supermercado.
Yes.
And you see all this artwork on the wall. And then you pass by, you know, you go down I think it's First Street. And then you hit Little Tokyo. And there's a really awesome extension that takes you into Union Station, and from the Gold Line East, it goes, it's like a huge bridge over the freeway. And you're just like, you know, this is like a fun ride. It feels like you're at the monorail at Disneyland.
I know. I was just going to say, like, now I want to take it farther than Burbank to Pasadena. I want to go all the way.
Right. So when you get past Union Station and go through Chinatown, you immediately, you know, go back down to Surface Street level, and you're going through like Angelina Heights. You're going through Highland Park and Lincoln Heights, and then
at street level.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the track is between the hills, so you're like just going between the hills.
Wild.
And it's pretty nice. It's really you got to do it.
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah.
I'm sold.
Cool thing too is, I mean, you know, that could be your ride to Pasadena.
Yeah.
Then you know you could find many things to do out there as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been getting into this bike riding around town, and there's so much to see that you just don't see in a car, you know?
Right.
Even like following alongside of some of the car paths, it's like, whoa, this is what's just over there. I drive this way all the time. I've never seen this. I didn't know this was right beside the road, you know?
Right. I mean, I've always, you know, I've been trying to encourage people to go to more Dodger games. and don't drive doing it because it's like, you know, again, it's the gas factor, the parking factor. And the thing is, because Dodger Stadium, a lot of times you're going to park far. And if there's, you have little kids with you, you know, it could be dangerous, you know, to walk from where you parked to the front door.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you got people tailgating, you got just, you know, 52,000 capacity.
Yeah.
Lots of cars.
It's pretty tight, I mean, to get up in there. I mean, you know, everyday traffic around there is real tight.
So, I mean, you know, if that Dodger MTA shuttle exists, and what's cool about that is they park it on this east entrance of Union Station, which is Vignes, V-I-G-N-E-S. And like, you know, say like, you know, you're coming from, you know, Riverside, West Covina, Covino, Whittier. If you could just take a bus or park your car at the Beverly and Atlantic Gold Line station, you could, for $1.50 each person, one way, take an 18-minute Gold Line ride from Atlantic and Beverly by East LA College, straight to Union Station, exit, and go to the Dodger shuttle, show them your Dodger ticket, and get a free ride to Dodger Stadium. And you know what's rad? Is that not only is it a free ride, but it drops you off at the front gate.
At the front gate.
Yeah, like it just bypasses everything. And it's not like the front doors of like home plate, but it's like right behind the outfield, which what there's, you know, there's entrances there.
Yeah.
But I mean, it just saves all that. And they run every 15 minutes.
That sounds really convenient. Yeah.
And on the way back. So people that want to partake in that also, they could, you know, if they're coming from, like we're mentioning, the Valley and Hollywood, they would just take the red line into Union Station from the north and hit the back entrance.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter where you're coming from. It's there it is. Once you get to Union Station, boom, right to the front door.
Exactly. And, you know, part of the Los Angeles NISA format is talking about places in specific geographies and telling people how to get there by public transportation, you know, save money, get more out of the city by seeing more and experiencing more. So what I want to ask you is, what are some of your favorite venues to see live music?
My favorite venues.
All sizes.
Well, I like the El Rey. I've seen a few shows there recently that are, you know, it's cozy. It's not too big. Every seat's pretty good.
Right.
You know, I like for being able to see a band, the Wiltern, you know, pretty much everywhere is good, although I have my reservations about the sound there, but I've enjoyed every show I've been to there.
What was the last show you saw there?
Oh, I saw Soundgarden there.
Right. And tell me about the sound there, in your opinion. What's wrong with it?
Well, it's just a little fuzzy. I've had it explained to me by some audio engineers why it is the way it is, although I won't be able to relate that here myself. So it makes sense. It's just because of the way the building's built. But having said that, it's a wonderful building. You know, the Art Deco features in the building are really magnificent. It's, not a bad seat really in the whole place. So
right. I mean, I think Cap is like, what, 2,500?
Is that what it is?
I mean, it's pretty big. I mean, but it's like the way it's designed, because it's such a big balcony, the floor is not too far.
Yeah, when I saw Soundgarden there, I saw them the third night that they played there recently.
2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, and it was rammed all the way up to the top.
Yeah, yeah. I went on the Friday show. They're a great band. I've seen many different shows there. I've seen Halford. Mm-hmm. I've seen Soundgarden. I've seen Queens of the Stone Age. Mastodon.
I saw Mastodon there. I saw Caius, Killing Joke. I've seen a few shows there.
Also, The Breeders.
Oh, The Breeders.
So I've seen a lot of different bands, and I know exactly what you're talking about as far as the sound goes. And it has nothing to do. I mean, I think, you know, when you're in the very back, there's a weird washiness happening.
Yeah.
And it's just from the architecture, right?
That's yeah, it hasn't stopped me from going there. You know, the Wiltern, what can I say? It's a good theater. Kind of reminds me of the Fox Theater in Pomona, but that's kind of getting out of Los Angeles. But
right. Well, that's still LA County though.
Ah.
That is. But you know what's awesome, little fun fact, is that people don't know this, but the Wiltern Theater is a East LA friendly venue. You know why?
Well, I know why.
Because the Line 720 that starts at Whittier and Atlantic, that goes all the way to the ocean, Santa Monica.
Whittier?
Yeah. Whittier. No, but basically, you know, the cool thing is it's a Santa Monica and East LA friendly venue. The reason why is the Line 720 rapid bus runs, I want to say it starts at 4 in the morning and it goes to about 1 o'clock.
So yeah, it doesn't shut down for too long.
Yeah. So the thing is that it runs along Whittier Boulevard, and Whittier turns into 6th Street, and then it hooks a left on another street, then it goes onto Wilshire all the way to the water. So anyone from East LA can get to the Wiltern for $1.50 each way. And not only that, it's a rapid bus. So the rapid bus, they have a sensor where they actually control the streetlights, mm-hmm. like when it's coming.
Oh, really?
And it keeps everything green for a long time. It's pretty amazing. And I've taken it, you know, just,
and the shows don't go too late at the Wiltern.
No, they're at, you know, in LA at a professional venue like that, it's, you know, there has to be a curfew.
Yeah, so it's like 11:30 midnight. You can wrap up and still get on a bus back to East LA. No sweat.
Yeah, or the other way to Santa Monica. So that one bus, 720, coming from either direction will take you to the Wiltern for a concert. And you just eliminated your gas prices. You just eliminated your parking. And again, you know, you're getting to see the city. You could write those emails and text messages and be productive on the bus.
And so does that go all the way down to La Brea as well? So if you were at the El Rey, the same bus line would
the 720. You know what? Actually,
or does it move somewhere?
It actually takes a turn, but then goes back on Wilshire after the El Rey.
Okay.
The El Rey is the line 20.
The line 20.
Yeah. But a lot of people don't know that you could get to the Wiltern from the water or from East LA. With one bus, and it's a rapid bus. So from East LA or the water, it takes about 30 minutes.
Yeah, so it's an express.
And it's $1.50 each way. So pretty much those places would probably take you about 40, 45 minutes if it was, you know, peak hour traffic.
So if you're planning, if you want to go to a show and you think it's too far to go into LA, think again.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like you could cover a lot of ground with public transportation, and you know, people could always welcome inbox messages on Facebook to instruct people how to get there, because sometimes the MTA.net PDFs are a little, intimidating to people as far as them taking too long to download, mm-hmm. and you know, cracking it open and trying to read it. Like a rapid bus and a red line bus or a subway and all the rail lines, they run often enough where you don't need a times table.
Yeah.
You know, so what about other venues?
Well, I go to a lot of venues. Sometimes I end up on the strip. I'll go to the Key Club or the Whiskey or the Roxy or On the Rocks once in a while has good bands like your band.
Oh, thank you.
And I go to the Redwood. I go to the Down and Out.
Right.
I go to, I go up to Highland Park on Tuesdays for the Heavy Footsies. Metal Night on Tuesday night there.
Right.
And so I kind of get around it. There's a place called Skinny's. I've been to some shows up in NoHo.
Uh-huh.
In North Hollywood. I'm trying to think here. That's a few. And then, of course, you know, there's the Los Globos. And
you know what's cool about the Sunset Strip is that if you're going to see shows at the Whiskey, Roxy, or Key Club, or On the Rocks, even the Troubadour, those are UCLA friendly venues.
Okay,
because the line 2, there used to be two lines, line 2 and 3, but the line 2 bus goes from downtown to UCLA, and it's just and that's 24 hours, a straight shot. So people that are like, you know, in the dorms that don't have a car, they could just, you know, wait for the bus and take it in to see a show and walk back out of the venue. Literally.
Yeah.
There's a stop right there in front of each venue. I mean, that's not so bad.
So the strip is student friendly.
It's UCLA student friendly. I mean, you know, when you put it like that to people, it kind of opens up, you know, a whole window of opportunities to go to more shows.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have to be such a big deal to get to shows without a car.
Is there a way to get in and out of seeing a show at Spaceland or Los Globos if you're up in that area?
That same number 2.
The number 2 goes all the way there too.
All the way past Los Globos because it goes to downtown.
Okay.
And you know, Dodger Stadium, you know, you're right below it. The satellite's a little more tricky because there's a bus line that runs right by it. But you have to get off the number 2 and connect to something else. But I've always just walked.
Yeah.
You know, that's the easiest. Personally, for me, what I like doing, like if I actually like don't have any business commitments on a weekend or my band's not doing nothing, I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to go out and just go do as much as I can. I like walking in front of my house in Ball Heights getting to line 18, going over the bridge, getting on the red line, going backwards to Union Station, going to Alvarez Street, doing my thing there, meeting up with people. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but they have that little gallery.
On Alvarez Street?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Check that out, see what's showing there, you know, whose work is up there. Maybe get a drink at Trax, get back on the red line, go up to Civic Center, which is the City Hall stop, go to the Redwood. That's how you get to the Redwood. And then, you know, catch a band, go to the next stop, Pershing Square, La Cita.
La Cita, yes,
yeah.
La Cita.
Cool venue.
Yes, it's a very cool venue.
It's very unique.
I've been to the Angry Hour.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
The Angry Hour, yeah. La Cita.
The Angry Hour,
yep. And that's, yeah, that's, I mean, it looks like a lot of people are enjoying themselves at the Angry Hour.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, and if you continue on to the red line, I mean, you could just get back on, continue to go northbound towards Hollywood, and you could definitely, you know, partake in different things. Like, so the next stop and option would be going to get off Vermont and Sunset and walking up Vermont. You're in Los Feliz.
And what station do we have? I guess it would be Union Station. But to get down to like 4th and Alameda, do you know the Japanese market that's there? 4th and Alameda.
Yes.
There's a great restaurant that I go to there called Shojin. No, but I don't know which way you would go.
You would transfer to the Gold Line.
The Gold Line.
And that gets off on 1st and Alameda.
Okay.
Right. So you just walk 3 blocks.
3 blocks.
Yeah, that's not too bad. And so, I mean, you know, you could really make an evening out of the Red Line. And another thing is, after leaving La Cita, you could go to the other side of the Pershing Square station and go to the Millennium Biltmore Hotel, go in the lounge on weekends, and they have the most amazing jazz.
Oh.
Yeah. Catch some of that, jump back on, and then head to Los Feliz. You know, it's just, you can cover so much ground with so little money and so little headache as well. So there's also that. And then, you know, you work your way up to Hollywood and Vine, Pantages, W Hotel, or Hollywood and Highland, and so forth. So, you know, there's tons of things to do. Obviously, along that line, not every line has many things to do. But I believe that, you know, the Red Line is definitely a nightlife option.
Yeah.
You know, to design like a whole evening out of using that. And the Gold Line is definitely, in my opinion, like, take it to go get Sunday brunch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Take it from Union Station, go have brunch in Pasadena. Have a nice ride to and from. I mean,
absolutely.
It's amazing. But how about galleries?
Well, I go to the LACMA, the MoCA. Mm-hmm. You know, the MoCA during maybe the art walk.
Right. Did you see the Kubrick exhibit?
At LACMA? No, that was at LACMA. Yeah, I saw the Kubrick, the Caravaggio. The Surrealists were going on at the same time. And that was sort of over the holidays. I was just down at it was some sort of, it wasn't Zine Fest, but it was some sort of art book festival at MoCA.
Oh, okay.
And that was on a Saturday afternoon. So did I drive? I drove there. So, but we went to the MoCA, went to Shojin. Like I said, that's a vegan sushi place, which is way over the top.
Are you actually vegan?
No, I'm not vegan. I'm vegetarian, but if there's vegan options, I'm not shy. But this sushi, we went there actually on my birthday, and I got turned on it. I've since been there like 3 or 4 other times. I can't really get enough of this place. And it's upstairs there on the third level at that market at 4th and Alameda. And man, it's better than real sushi. We had guys that are like real sushi eaters, and they're just like, they wouldn't have even been able to tell the difference for one, but just like so impressed with just how amazing it was. So that's sort of like a, you know, little Tokyo sort of become a destination and fitting things in and around that. Like, well, if we go to the MoCA, we can always kind of cruise over down to Shojin and sort of like, you know, consolidate our travels, you know.
Right. And there's also Señor Fish.
Ah.
On 1st and Alameda. It's like the first thing when you get off the Gold Line on the southwest corner of 1st and Alameda, which is, it's cool because it's kind of like, it's like a Mexican bar and grill
mm-hmm.
with like great fish items, So it's you know, reasonably priced, great customer service. And there's also next door to that a brewery, and across street from both of those places is the American Japanese Museum.
Have you been up to Bergamot Station?
No.
In Santa Monica?
No.
And it's like a series of galleries. You know, they call it Bergamot Station, but there's like a number of different galleries in that sort of, I don't know, would you call it a complex or, if you will, something to look up. It's in Santa Monica. And also, what is it? The Hammer, which is in West Hollywood.
Yep.
I was there a while back. You know, that's covering a few of the ones that I frequent more often, but.
Right. What about the, for me, what about sporting events? So for you, you do mostly Kings games, right?
Yeah, I'm only Kings. I've only warmed up to the Kings since I've been here, but sounds like the Clippers wouldn't be too bad to, you know, go to, but for now, it's just the Kings. But I mean, I chose my team not being from here.
Right.
Last year, I was becoming immersed in hockey because everyone that I was hanging around, my girlfriend and her friends, are all big on hockey. Now, I come from Vancouver.
Huge hockey.
You know, Canada, Vancouver, Canucks, and everyone was like, well, who's going to be your team? And I said, well, I eat, live, and breathe and sleep in Los Angeles, so I'm going to choose the Kings. And the Kings weren't doing very well at the beginning of last year, so it was kind of surprising. People are like, no. How can you choose them? They're not even doing good. And I'm just like, this is where I live. This is going to be my team. And lo and behold, it was a good year to get into the Kings.
Gotcha. Now, let's turn the page here. How about when you shop for records? Where do you go?
I go to Amoeba.
That's the destination, man.
I go to Amoeba.
You know, I could spend 3 hours in there.
Yeah.
Could you?
I could. I just went to a place up in Atwater called Jackknife.
Uh-huh.
I guess there's permanent records up in
Eagle Rock. Right. But Amoeba's your home when it comes to buying records?
Yeah, pretty much. Because I don't usually go into the west side of Sunset too much. So I don't make it over to, there's a couple other good stores over there. The one in Echo Park, Origami, and then.
Well, what about Vacation?
Vacation, yeah. No, I don't usually make it up there. It's not really on my path.
Oh, gotcha.
It could be. I should, but it's just like I'm not usually cutting through Silver Lake.
Yeah. Well, Robert, thank you so much. That's a wrap.
Thank you for having me.
And this is a part of the Sound City movie installment. We'll have more guests this week, and we'll keep you informed once they confirm. Right now, you could download the producer of Sound City Movie, his episode with me at the Los Angeles Nista page, or just go to iTunes, and I'm sure this will be up sooner than later. We'll get it out there online once everything is up, hopefully tonight. And we'll leave you now with, in its casual track called The Goal Line.